Radio Prague News.
A record bark beetle infestation is set to double in 2019. The headquarters of Czech tourism and the regional development ministry were raided by police, and a survey shows Czechs borrow well beyond their means at Christmas. A bark beetle infestation that has affected spruce forests throughout the country, said to be the worst in the past 200 years, is likely to double in 2019. This according to a forest management expert at the Ministry of Agriculture. Due to the infestation, the Czech Republic's largely coniferous forests are already facing extensive felling of trees, which could negatively impact many animal species, including hawks and white-tailed eagles. The Ministry of Agriculture is calling for amending the Forestry Act and implementing a new crisis plan. Anti-corruption police officers staged raids on Wednesday morning at the headquarters of both the Ministry for Regional Development and the state agency Czech Tourism. The head of the Prague Public Prosecutor's Office said the officers were collecting evidence related to Czech tourism contracts, but declined to elaborate further. 2 years ago, police investigated the agency after the Supreme Audit Office filed a criminal complaint over spending discrepancies. Czech Army Chief of Staff Aleš Opata has said the country's armed forces urgently need to make a series of purchases, ranging from protective gear for soldiers in the field to helicopters and radar systems, the Daily Pravo reports. Opata said these items include bulletproof vests and helmets, hand weapons, drones, NATO-caliber artillery, infantry fighting vehicles, three-dimensional mobile air defense radars, and multipurpose helicopters. Downward pressure on the Czech crown will likely continue for years to come due to gradual sell-offs by foreign investors who bought a large volume of the currency during the three-year period of intervention by the Czech National Bank to keep the currency artificially weaker, according to analysts. The crown weakened to below 26 to the euro in mid-November, its lowest level since June, when the central bank began a series of interest rate hikes, of which there have now been five in 2018. Pressure on the crown is unlikely to ease for the rest of the year as Czech economic growth lagged behind its regional peers in the third quarter. Photographer Lukáš Zeman came first in the 2018 Czech press photo competition with a picture of an orangutan and its dying infant. The winning photo illustrates the destruction of nature in Borneo and breaks with a tradition of politically themed pictures winning the annual Czech contest. The news section of Czech press photo was won by Michal Čizek, with an image of honor chief Andrej Babiš giving a kiss of gratitude to his PR chief, Marek Prchal, after the elections in 2017. Czechs borrow most in the weeks leading up to Christmas, including by taking advantage of credit offered by retailers, according to a new survey commissioned by the Czech Consumers Association. During the course of the year, on average, about 27% have borrowed beyond their means. Twice as many do so between mid-November and early December, the survey found. And finally, the weather. Thursday should be partly cloudy throughout the country, with occasional light rain, sleet, or snow, likely especially in the Vysočina and southern Moravian regions. Daytime highs should range between 1 to 5 degrees Celsius. I'm Brian Kennedy, and that's the news for now.
You are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, a Roma social worker from the Czech Republic is on the BBC's list of inspirational women for 2018. And Jaromír Jágr is to be the public face of the ice hockey tournament at the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. Later on, we'll look at EU efforts to combat Russian disinformation campaigns. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Elena Gorolova, a Roma social worker from the North Moravian city of Ostrava, has been included on an annual BBC list of 100 inspirational and influential women for 2018. The BBC highlighted Ms. Gorolova's campaign against forced sterilization, as well as her work to return institutionalized children to their birth families, Ruth Frankova reports.
Although there are no official figures, it is estimated that there were thousands of women in the Czech Republic and formerly communist Czechoslovakia who were sterilized against their will or without proper consent between the years 1979 and 2001. The victims were predominantly members of the Roma minority, but also women who were mentally ill or who were in institutions. Elena Gorolova herself was sterilized without her knowledge in 1990 at the age of 21 after giving birth to her second son. She says the event had a deep effect on her life.
There were difficult moments, including problems with my husband, who would, from time to time, suspect me of having undergone the sterilization of my own free will. Within the Roma community, not being able to have children is regarded as a disgrace. Many women were actually abandoned by their husbands because they wanted more children and were ashamed of their wives. But my husband eventually understood what happened and he even helped me in my struggle.
In 2005, Elena Gorolova joined the group Vzájemné soužití, or Life Together, an Ostrava-based NGO which demanded a public apology for the practice and compensation to the illegally sterilized Roma women. She eventually became the group's spokeswoman and, among other things, testified at a Council of Europe meeting in Strasbourg. In 2009, the government led by Jan Fischer officially apologized for the practice, although several cases of forced sterilization have since been tried at the courts. None of the victims have been compensated. Elena Gorolová again.
We haven't received any compensation yet, but we have done a lot of work over the past years. At the beginning, most of the women wouldn't even talk to anyone, but then they started testifying and even organized a demonstration outside the maternity hospital in Ostrava. So we've done a lot of work. We got an official apology and forced sterilizations are no longer being carried out. If these women hadn't found the courage to speak up, no one would have known about the problem.
Kdyby tyto ženy nezačaly takhle pracovat a nedokázaly jako vystoupit, tak by se o tom nikdy nemluvilo.
Elena Gorolová, who is 49 today, currently works to return institutionalized children to their birth families and also fights against segregation of Roma women in maternity hospitals. Among other nominees included on the BBC list of 100 inspirational and influential women for 2018 are professional leaders as well as everyday heroes ranging from more than 60 countries, from the 16-year-old Azerbaijani student who found a company that harvests energy from rainwater, to a 90-year-old Japanese pensioner who started learning English to help guide tourists who will visit Tokyo for the city's 2020 Olympics.
Ruth Frankova with that report. Moving on now, Jaromír Jágr is to be the public face of the ice hockey tournament at Beijing's Winter Olympic Games in 2022. Jágr thus joins Canadian legend Wayne Gretzky among the personalities that are helping prepare and develop Chinese ice hockey. But it's not only on the level of personalities that cooperation is growing. Tom McEncrow has the details.
One of the greatest legends of Czech ice hockey, Jaromír Jágr, will become the official public face of the ice hockey tournament at the Beijing Winter Olympic Games in 2022. The announcement came after a meeting between Czech President Miloš Zeman and the Vice Premier of the Chinese State Council, Sin Chunlan, in Lane on Monday. Jágr is not the only star to become involved in developing hockey in the Asian superpower. Wayne Gretzky recently announced his involvement as well. Hockey expert Pavel Procházka from the Czech newspaper Deník N, which broke the story, explains China's motivation behind the move.
They're collecting the most famous players in ice hockey history in order to popularize the sport in China. Wayne Gretzky has his own hockey school for young players, and it seems likely it will open to Chinese talent as well.
It is not the first cooperation announcement between Czech representatives of the sport and their Chinese counterparts. In 2017, a memorandum between the Czech Ice Hockey Association and China was signed. It features pledges to cooperate in training camps for young players, coach exchanges, and methodology. The association's spokesman, Zdeněk Zikmund, described ongoing activities.
It is more of a general document which serves as an umbrella for mutual activities on the club level. Nevertheless, some projects have already taken place. For example, we had a group of Chinese players between the ages of 14 and 16 attend a week-long training camp. They were trained by Czech coaches. The players were also accompanied by coaches from China who received a number of specialized lectures.
Teams such as Bílí Tygři Liberec, Vítkovice, Karlovy Vary and Plzeň have signed special agreements with Chinese partners and are cooperating especially on the level of youth development. While China's untapped market offers obvious commercial benefits, Mr. Procházka says it could also help bring Chinese talent to the Czech league.
China is a large country with a vast population, so I think that one way in which Czech ice hockey can profit from this cooperation is in securing some of the future Chinese talent for the Czech Extraliga clubs, either through loans or signings.
Apart from the Czech Republic, China has also asked Canada and Russia for cooperation. Meanwhile, NHL teams have been playing some of their pre-season games in China since 2017, and the league is in the process of setting up an office in the country. Closer cooperation has been taking place also in football, with legendary Czech footballer Pavel Nedvěd serving as the sports ambassador in China, and he is one of the public faces of the Chinese Super League.
Tom McEncrow with that report. A reminder that you're with Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's now time for our main feature with Brian Kennedy.
Jakub Kalinský was among the first to join the skeleton staff of the East Stratcom Task Force, the European Union's first direct initiative to identify, debunk, and counter Russia's disinformation campaigns. For the first year or so of the task force, established in the summer of 2015, the Czech former journalist was also the only team member devoted solely to that monumental task. In other words, Jakub Kalinský not only led, but in fact was the EU's team in Brussels for countering disinformation, responsible for overseeing the EU versus Disinfo campaign and its flagship product, the weekly Disinfo Review. The situation was such that 2 years into the project, in March 2017, more than 120 people from across government, media, security and civil society signed on to an open letter accusing the EU of being irresponsibly weak on disinformation. In a wide-ranging interview, Mr. Kalinský shared his insights into the nature of Russia's disinformation efforts and the varying degrees of awareness in Europe about the extent of the problem. I began by asking him how, on a shoestring budget, the team had managed at all to make a difference.
It is true that the beginnings were a bit tough. I mean, we were a team of seven, and we were supposed to cover the three objectives that were written in the action plan approved by the member states for our team. So we were created by the Council conclusions in 2015, meaning the 28 heads of state agreed on something, and in this case it was the need to challenge the ongoing Russia's disinformation campaign. How do we do that? These are the three points or three objectives in the action plan. The first of them was better communicating the EU policies in the Eastern Partnership neighbourhood. The second objective was supporting the independent media in this region, and the third objective only was actually raising the awareness about Russia's disinformation campaign. So majority of my colleagues were working on objectives one and two, and it is true that in year one it was only me who was fully dedicated on objective three, although I was usurping quite a lot of their time because I really needed some help with promoting the products and stuff like that. So yeah, when you don't have the resources, you have to adjust to the situation. So there was the option that we will only be a window dressing, and we didn't want to be that. So we cooperated a lot with partners outside of Brussels. We tried to identify those people and organizations who are already working on countering disinformation. The role model was definitely the Ukrainian Stop Fake, who are really the pioneers of countering disinformation via exposing it. And when you expose the disinformation, you have to say, why is it a disinformation? So there is the element of debunking, fact-checking. So we try to basically copy-paste this model and raise it to the European level. We weren't 100% successful, but it was a step in the right direction, I believe, and we got quite a lot of praise for that, I think.
What was a typical day like for you in that first month or two? Uh-huh. And how did the work evolve over time? You got mm-hmm. more help, as you say. Mm-hmm. But
Well, in the first month, we were actually discussing what are we going to do. And since month two, we started implementing it. But yeah, since the implementation, I think it was like 3 days, 3 or 4 days a week where dedicated to actually producing the disinformation review. That was our flagship product, where we tried to collect and expose as many disinformation messages as we could get. You know, the side effect of it was that, for example, when if you highlight a disinformation when it's still only in the Russian language media space, you can actually warn other language spaces. We heard it many times from Lithuania, from Czech Republic, from the UK. You know, you have shown us a disinformation before it was actually translated into our languages, so we were already prepared that this is coming. So this was like, 3 or 4 days per week, and the rest of it was dealing with the other tasks. So when your task is to raise the awareness, you are also talking at conferences and seminars publicly. You are trying to engage with the member states. Very often the member states were reaching out to us, asking us actually for a piece of advice, because it was a new problem for pretty much everybody in 2015. I think only the Baltic states were experienced enough in the European Union. It was also a lot of background briefings for journalists. We didn't talk to them on the record, but we were briefing them off the record. So that took you kind of the rest of the week. And obviously you have to read quite a lot about Russia's disinformation. Those 3 days when you try to compile the disinfo review, that was probably the hardest, because you have to... you know it yourself from the journalistic work, fact-checking or verifying is actually quite time-consuming. And watching the aggressive TV shows on Russian state channels, that can be exhausting.
Almost like entering a kind of Alice in Wonderland alternative universe.
Maybe more like, you know, George Orwell's 2 minutes of hatred, maybe like that, but it goes on for 3 hours.
At that time, when you joined, was there already wide awareness of the what are now well-publicized, the Russian kind of troll factories, the Internet Research Association and this kind of outfit?
I believe in the frontline states there was quite a high awareness about this phenomenon. I think already in 2015, when the brave Russian journalist Lyuda Savchuk infiltrated the troll factory. She was there, for example, on the day when Boris Nemtsov was killed. I believe it was the end of February 2015. And she was describing the pattern of work that we have seen so many times since then. You know, when Boris Nemtsov was killed, the bosses told them to stop doing everything and to start spreading conflicting stories about what happened. So person A will say he was killed by the Americans to blame Putin. Person B will say he was killed by the Ukrainians to blame Putin. Person C will say he was killed by the Russian opposition to blame Putin. And you see that here in these situations, the aim is not really to persuade you about one version of events, but to actually exhaust your critical thinking, and so that the average media consumer will end up saying there are too many versions of truth and I don't know which one is right.
By some estimates, the Kremlin devotes well over 1 billion euros a year to its propaganda machine, including via open official channels such as RT Television, the former Russia Today, which has a presence in some 100 countries, and the state news agency Sputnik, which was launched a few months after Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea from Ukraine, and which publishes stories now in 33 languages.
On top of that, the now infamous troll farms that systematically spread disinformation are also heavily financed from the Russian state budget, and their content replicated by thousands of purported news websites around the globe. By comparison, the EU's East Stratcom Task Force still has an annual budget of under 1 million euros, 1,000 times less. EU Justice Commissioner Věra Jourová:
this is not enough. In June this year, the European Council tasked the Commission and the External Action Service to develop an action plan on tackling disinformation. This action plan, which we are currently working on, will outline specific proposals for a coordinated EU response to the challenge of disinformation. We will build on existing initiatives, such as the work of the East Stratcom Task Force.
The EU executive arm is, however, now drafting an action plan to be presented to EU member states in December. It is expected to call for significantly bolstering the East Stratcom team ahead of the next elections to the European Parliament this coming spring.
Mr. President, honorable members, I would like to thank the Parliament for this most urgent plenary debate. We will have elections to the European Parliament in May 2019, and 50 various elections will have taken place by 2020. We have to adjust the protection of the integrity of our elections to the digital age.
EU Justice Commissioner Věra Jourová there, a Czech national and former MP, addressing a plenary session of the European Parliament in Strasbourg on the 14th of November. She warns that the risk of interference and manipulation into European elections has never been so high, stressing that the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal sent shockwaves through democratic systems worldwide about how voters' personal data and opinions can be so easily manipulated. The European Commission recently announced a code of practice on disinformation that tech platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Google, have said they will abide by. But, Ms. Jourová says, that in itself will never be enough. She is calling for greater funding for the European External Action Service, that's the EU's diplomatic corps, which oversees the East Stratcom Task Force, developing an action plan, and greater coordination with other bodies working to combat hybrid threats.
Investigations are ongoing into allegations of dark financing from undisclosed third country sources. The most cited source of activities interfering with elections in Europe is Russia. Given the very nature of our Union, electoral interference in one member state affects the EU as a whole. National authorities cannot address these threats by working in isolation, nor can private sector self-regulation solve it all.
According to Jakub Kolensky, the East Stratcom Task Force already cooperates with a volunteer network of some 500 NGOs, diplomats, think tanks, and other media professionals who regularly monitor and forward on examples of disinformation to the team.
When you imagine that there is one third of people who can believe a version of events that is contradicting to all the facts, and that someone is actually playing this audience like a violin, this can really be dangerous, especially when you keep in mind that during the elections and referenda, you do not need to persuade 51% of the population, no. When we have a look at the Brexit referendum or the US presidential elections, or even the Czech presidential elections this year, these were all elections that were decided by a very small percentage of the population. And if you know how your audience is going to behave, if you can control what information it receives, and if you know that it doesn't have to have anything to do with reality, this is a very dangerous cocktail.
Now, speaking of the Czech Republic, this country, under the Interior Ministry, has a special center that is devoted to disinformation and terrorism, and in fact links them, puts them in the same basket, as it were. Is this actually unique to the Czech Republic, and to what degree did you work with this center?
It is true that you do not see it extremely often, that disinformation is in one basket with terrorism. So this might be unique for the Czech Republic. I believe the most similar organization I have seen, although it is a much bigger building, much bigger organization, would be the MSB in Sweden, the Civil Contingency Agency, and they are also focusing on, for example, preparing the level of civil servants, but also politicians, simply decision makers, to prepare them for critical situations like disinformation campaign during the elections. But they are also working on protecting the soft targets against terrorist attacks. And for example, they were also helping a lot during the recent fires, you know, in Sweden in summer. So their mandate is significantly broader than this Czech team's. We were surely in touch. Obviously, it helped the people here in Prague that they are in touch with someone in Brussels who can share the experience with them. And for me, obviously, it was very useful to have someone here in Prague, because otherwise I would rely only on information from the media, which I believe report actually quite well. And it is fair to say that Czech outlets were much quicker in realizing this is a problem than many of the Western European outlets. But it's always better to have the primary source of information.
Jakub Kolensky left the East Stratcom task force in November to join the Atlantic Council think tank as a senior fellow specializing in pro-Kremlin disinformation campaigns. He will also lead its Ukrainian election task force. Apart from all that, and while working to raise awareness of the gravity of the issue, especially in countries not on the front lines, he hopes to build additional bridges between governments and civil society groups active in this area. Although he expects to be working from Prague for about 2 weeks out of every month, Mr. Kolensky does not anticipate, nor see the need, to devote more time to the issue in his home country.
If I evaluate the European countries, I don't think that Czech Republic is the country where you need to persuade a lot of people that more should be done. I think actually Czech Republic is among those states where the response is slightly better than average. On the working level, I think it's brilliant because it's the Ministry of Interior working on this problem, Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Also the secret services are working on this topic. Although I believe they could help, for example, the journalists a bit more when it goes to, for example, tracking who is the owner of Aeronet and how are they getting their instructions. When you have a look at what's happening in for example, Estonia, the Kapo, the Internal Security Service, they are really disclosing quite a lot of information, and I think the Czechs could also be doing a bit more. But still, I think the Czechs, at least on the working level and on the level of the civil society, we do have some NGOs and think tanks who are working on this topic. We have a few journalists who are working on this topic. But it's not only these dozens and dozens of disinformation websites, but it's also the social media trolls you have mentioned. It's also the chain emails that not many people in the West know about. But here in this region of Europe, they are extremely effective because people above 50, 55, they do not use social media. And it's these chain emails that are their social media. It's also the Russian state TV, which is crucial for Russian-speaking minority. We don't have that many Russian speakers here in Czech Republic, but it is a very important audience, not only in the Baltic states, but, for example, in Germany, as we have seen during the last German elections. So you are trying as many tools as possible, and then you have a good chance to achieve the result. We can see that actually the Russians are really good in adjusting the message for the right audience, at finding the right target audience. They do have different messages, not only for different countries, but also for different socioeconomic groups. They will have a different message for a high-ranked diplomat and a different message for a poorly educated senior somewhere on the countryside. And the development I see in micro-targeting of the messages is scary. You know, it is fashionable to now talk about the so-called deepfakes, you know, the new technology tool that allows you to fake a video, and the technology is becoming already so cheap, it will probably be quite easy to use that. But I'm a bit more scared about this micro-targeting, because it seems to me that the development there is really going in the direction where you could have a different disinformation message for so many different audiences that we simply won't be able to catch up.
Jakub Kolensky of the East Stratcom Task Force, ending that in-depth report by Brian Kennedy. And I'm afraid that's all we have for you today. You'll find us at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then our email address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. And of course, you can always follow Radio Prague on Facebook and Twitter. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today, and take care.